So this is the first day of our three-day retreat here in October at the Franciscan Center here in Tampa. Supposedly the weather will be cooling down and we'll have some refreshing cool breezes over the next few days. Hopefully by now everyone has settled in a bit, getting somewhat comfortable with the silence, getting comfortable with the practice of mindfulness, and are strictly, to the best of your ability, observing the parameters of the boundaries that were set up last night, doing our best to needlessly wander into the ruminations of the past, the fantasies, fears about the future, or even the need to think too much about the present. The present is wonderful just as it is. It doesn't need our help to make it better. Just a few practical things. There was a little confusion in the individual meetings this morning. So again, if you're the first one and the second one, every 15 minutes, you go upstairs when I go upstairs. Okay, and then when I ring the first bell, the first person comes in, the second person is seated, and then when, after 15 minutes, when I ring the next bell, the person who has the meeting in 15 minutes, please come upstairs so you're ready to go. Again, with 15 minutes is not a lot of time. I do want to be able to spend all that time with you, and so we don't want to take too much time in between. Also, the schedule. Please try to arrive. I mean, I know often we try to be punctual, but try to be a little better than punctual, which means if the sitting begins at 6:30, try to get here at least a few minutes before, if not 5 or 10 minutes before. In that way, we can begin all together on time. We're settled, so we have a few minutes to settle down together, and then when the bell is invited and the morning or evening chants are sung, we are all together on it. Any other practical things that we need to deal with? Everything else seems to be going well. So we have a great treat. You have to really be into Dharma to talk that way about teachings. Probably 99.9% of the population of this world would not think so. But those of us in this very rare universe here, we think it's a wonderful treat to be able to listen to, experience, and hopefully be awakened by these wonderful teachings of Bankei. I'll read a little bit of his life, just because I think it's very instructive. And again, please listen to it that way, like we said this morning. A Dharma talk is not just to entertain or even to instruct academically or intellectually or philosophically. It has a desire to kind of wake us up. So Bankei, he's 17th century, 1600s. An unusual man. And actually, his teachings actually died out in Japan. He really, even though he came out of certain lineages, he really blazed his own path and was quite wonderful and really one of the most popular teachers of his time. But because he was not institutionally driven, because he was not desirous of setting up an institution. I think over what happened over generations is that gradually his teaching, his disciples and disciples' disciples kind of ended up going back into the institutions of the major Zen schools and temples of his time. And it's only really recently that scholars and other Zen scholars in Japan kind of rediscovered him. He actually gave very strict instructions to his disciples. He never wrote anything. So the only thing that is written by him that's preserved are actually letters that he wrote people. And he also gave very strict instructions to his disciples, do not write down what I say. I mean, he was just that kind of, he was very much in interaction. And he wanted his teaching to be alive, and he was not concerned about fame or posterity. But luckily, he had some disciples who didn't listen to him. I mean, we are fortunate. And even though he gave strict instructions, do not write it down, we have some that did write it down. And so there are, again, not much. There are a couple of his major talks that he gave, a number of kind of anecdotes, interactions, and letters and things like that. But my sense is, for the amount of years that he taught, there is probably very little. But in a certain way, his teaching, he was very consistent and very simple in his teaching, so probably what has been preserved gives you a sense of him. I want to read from one of his talks in the beginning, then we'll go into his teaching, about his life. And this is from one of his longer talks. He said, "Oh, you are extremely fortunate." This is his talking to the people around him. He became quite well known, and hundreds, if not thousands, of people would attend his talks. Interestingly enough, all types of monks and nuns, but many, many lay people of all types. I mean, not just Zen had a tradition in Japan because of koan practice, and a lot of the teachings were in Chinese. Very attractive a lot to the intellectuals in the upper classes. Bankei, not that he didn't attract these kinds of disciples, but he really was a man of the people, and he felt that the unborn mind, the Buddha mind, was accessible to everyone. So this is in one of his talks. He said, "All of you are extremely fortunate. When I was a young man, it was different. I couldn't find a good teacher, and being headstrong, I devoted myself from early age to exceptionally difficult training, experiencing suffering others couldn't imagine. I expended a lot of useless effort. The experience of that needless ordeal is deeply ingrained in me. It's something I can never forget. That is why I come here like this day after day." Day after day, just "urging you to profit from my own painful experience so you can attain the Dharma easily, while you're seated comfortably on the tatami mat without all that unnecessary work. You should consider yourselves extremely fortunate because you won't find a teaching like this anywhere else." And again, a little further down, he says, "You can attain the Dharma without putting yourself through the arduous struggle I did. I want you to remember that carefully as you listen to what I say." So hopefully, as I read these words, you are not you're not seeing Fred reading these words, but you're hearing this from Bankei. He's talking to us. Okay, so please pay attention. And then he kind of goes through his early life. Basically, I won't read it all, but basically he described himself as a young man as a very stubborn, a very mischievous, and he was like the leader of the bad boys, in town, throwing rocks at people, getting into all kinds of trouble, never really being very respectful at school. he was a little bit of a rebel. And he also said, of course, from a young age, he had a real aversion to death and dying. So there was this other on the one hand, he's very stubborn and rebellious. On the other hand, he's very curious and he's deep. You know what I mean? Like 2-3 years old, anybody would talk about death or dying, and he'd kind of freak out. And he says that when he'd be mischievous or misbehave, all he had to do was talk about death or dying, he immediately would stop. I mean, so his family kind of use that as a way to control his behavior. But then he goes on to say that at the time, whatever he was going for school, it was Confucian, and he said the teacher would mention something about the way of learning lies in clarifying bright virtue. And supposedly, he just, you know, fastened on these words, bright virtue, these Confucian words, and he would ask his mother and family people, you know, what is bright virtue? And they would give him answers, and then when he'd go to school, he would question the Confucian scholar, you know, what is bright virtue? What does it really mean? They give him the kind of intellectual answers. He wasn't satisfied. So the Confucian said that since he and his fellow Confucians devoted all their time to explaining the literal meaning of the Confucian writings, they didn't know really what it meant. So therefore he stopped going to school. And he would be truant, and he'd get in big trouble with his brother, who felt that he should go to school, and his brother would go looking for him and beat him up, and because his father had died young, and so his elder brother was in charge. Somebody told him, by the time he was 13, his brother threw him out of the family. He was so sick of him. He was such an embarrassment. I mean, he wouldn't go to school. He was always in trouble. In those days, you know, they didn't have reform schools or anything. They just kind of, threw him out. So he you're on your own. You're a disgrace to the family. That issue of bright virtue meant to him. But he couldn't figure it out. He'd go around. Somebody told him about Zen. He'd go around to temples and listen to talks. And this is, he's 13 years old, 14 years old, and he just wasn't satisfied. Then he goes on, and he finally meets a Zen priest sometime in his adolescent years, who said he could understand bright virtue, but he had to meditate. So at this time, he went up into the mountains, and he sat without eating for 7 days, directly on the sharp surface of rocks. He took no thought for his health. He just was a fanatic. He said he just kept sitting day and night, didn't eat, until finally he just passed out. Because he said, because nobody knew where I was, nobody could bring me food. And so eventually this was not a guy who he was a very sort of way a typical adolescent. You know, he didn't have any much future thinking. You know, but the consequence, he just kind of jumped right in. So he passed out. He returned home again. I don't know. But again, they sent him off. And he went up to this temple, and this monk allowed him to build like a little shelter up in the mountains behind. And so, again, he just devoted himself to various kinds of Buddhist practices at times, chanting, recitations, meditation. He'd go long periods without sleep. He just pushed himself beyond his physical endurance. All kinds of his buttocks were lacerated because he was sitting on the bare rocks. Even though he said, I must have had a constitution of iron in those days, because I was able to go right on without spending even a single day lying down, even to recuperate when I was sick. To lessen the pain from my buttocks, I placed several layers of soft paper on the ground and sat on them, changing them frequently. I had to, because I would be bleeding on them, and they would get... I tried sitting on cotton wadding. So he goes on and on, but he still didn't rest. So this goes on for years, and really until he's around 24. He just continues... Again, he has this, on one hand, he has this burning desire to be awake, to know. You know, he had this burning question, what really is bright virtue? What really is the meaning of life? You know, what, at the same time, because he didn't have a good teacher or teaching, and just a little bit of this and that, he kind of was doing it on his own. And you can see he was quite headstrong and stubborn, and he was just going to tough his way through this. Finally, he said, the years of long physical punishment built up, and I had a serious illness, and I hadn't clarified bright virtue in spite of all my effort. He grew weaker and weaker. It sounds like he might have had TB, because now he's spitting up globs of blood. He said, there were kindly people who lived nearby, and said, that I should recuperate my health. So they gave him a hut. and they arrange for some young lad to kind of look after him, you know. But the illness had reached a critical stage. A whole week I couldn't swallow anything except rice broth. I resigned myself to the fact that I was going to die. I mean, he had just... I viewed it as inevitable, but felt no regret. The only thing that I regretted was that I was going to die without having discovered the meaning of bright virtue. So to understand what happens next, you have to really understand his mind. Okay? So here is a man who has been consumed with understanding something, right? What is bright virtue? You know, this central tenet of Confucianism, this thing we're supposed to cultivate, this thing that is underneath all beings. All beings have this. What is this bright virtue? What is it? You know? And couldn't find any explanation. So now, 8-10 years, he's just been going through different practices. Finally, he's just devoted himself in this way that he's gotten himself so sick. I mean, you got to understand the mindset. He is physically sick, right? And he is mentally sick, right? He's so sick, you know, he's about to die. Which obviously he could have. I mean, obviously he couldn't eat. He was spinning. He obviously had a significant case of TB in terms of everything else. And he's also, he's probably also in a profound sort of depression. You know what I'm saying? Because he realizes that he's about to die, and even though he's worked so hard, right, all these years, he hasn't. You know, it's for naught, right? So you can see. You know, psychologically, he's at the end of his rope. He's hit bottom, right? He's totally exhausted, physically, mentally, emotionally, right? Can you see? He's just, you know, he's been banging his head against the wall, and he's just, you know, nothing has worked. He's in a total state of despair. The only thing that really bothered me was having to die without discovering the meaning of bright virtue, which had had the sole possession of my thoughts for so long. And this is also important, too. He was very focused. Right? His mind wasn't all over the place. He wanted to understand this thing. He was totally absorbed by this question of what is bright virtue. Then I felt a strange sensation in my throat. I spat against the wall. A mass of black phlegm, large as a soapberry, rolled down the side. It seemed to relieve the discomfort in my chest. Suddenly, just at that moment, it came to me. I realized what it was that had escaped me until now. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. I realized, too, that what I'd been doing all this time had been mistaken. I knew all my efforts had been in vain. At the same time, my illness showed definite signs of improvement. Overjoyed, I found my appetite had returned. I called the nurse. I ate 2 or 3 bowls without any effect. From that point on, I improved steadily, and here I am, still alive today. I was able to fill my vow after all, and also to bring my mother to an understanding of the unborn. So what he's describing is what? An enlightenment experience that he had at that moment. Right? At the end of physical and mental exhaustion, when all his efforts, his self-efforts, were in vain, in that moment, Right. He does something which he'd been doing all along, you know, spitting up phlegm and blood. But in that moment of just seeing that against the wall, all of a sudden, everything just turned around, and he saw, it's just this, right? It's just this. And he called it, he said, all things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. What could it have been so simple, right? Right, you're phlegm in your throat, and what does your body do? It coughs it up, spits it out. And then what happens? It just drips down the wall. Now, if there's anybody here who's not enlightened at this moment, it's obviously because we don't have that mind state that he had. But what he describes here is common, really, mostly everyone's account of these kind of breakthrough moments, these kind of enlightenments, these kinds of turning about in the deepest seat of mind, when all of a sudden it becomes very clear how utterly simple it all is. And all one's attempts to understand, all those one's attempts to intellectualize, all those attempts to intellectually make sense of things, are all for naught. Right. And so this is what happened to him. Yes. Yes.
At that moment, he saw all things were resolved in the unborn. And
right.
His other thought was, all of this was for nothing.
Because it's
so
all...
I could equally imagine saying, oh my goodness, all my efforts have finally borne fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I've reached this point where I can now see.
Yeah. So it is like, you've been spending the last 20 years looking for your glasses. Right? Looking for your glasses. 20 years. Everywhere you've been looking. You've been all over every state, every place in the universe. And one day you go like this and you go, oh my God. I had them on all the time. Right? All that effort was in vain, because all you had to ever do was just reach up, and because they were here all the time. It's like that. Now, he didn't beat himself up. You know, this was not a psychological moment. It was a realization, right? That, you know, looking here and there for something that I thought I had lost, or something I had to understand, or something that was outside me, that was all in vain. It's right here. I have my glasses on all the time. All of us, maybe, who wear glasses have had that moment. I certainly have found many times where I'm running around looking for my glasses and they're just right here, or even sometimes quite embarrassing, I have them on. Right? It's that kind of moment. It's and you realize, right? It's like if I'm running around looking for my watch and I have it on all the time. Fred, your watch is... Oh. Right? So all my effort has been in vain. It has been in vain. He's saying the truth.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
But along with what Ken's saying, it seems to me that perhaps all those things were necessary precursors, because
he was so stubborn.
No, because the intensity of intention and aspiration, and I don't know.
But hold on. I know where you're going. Let's listen to his teaching,
okay.
Because that's not what he's saying. Okay. This is very important. So we got to listen very carefully. He's not saying that. And you'll get that when we get into his teaching. He's not saying what we'd like him to say, right? We'd like him to say that all that misguided effort, all those false starts, all that back and forth, all those things we've done have not been in vain, right? We want to hear that. He's very clear. I mean, if you remember his induction, he's saying, I am here to tell you that it was only because of my stubbornness and because I did not have a good teacher to show me the way that I did everything I did. I mean, I even skipped some paragraphs where he really, there's a whole paragraph here where he just talks to the young people. He says, you know, let me tell you, we're young. Don't make the mistakes I made. Okay, so please listen. Again, you know, certainly, you know, Jessica can look back on her life and go, well, I can understand why I did this and did this and did this, but that's still not saying that the things you did were not in vain, in the sense they didn't get you what you want. You can understand why you did it in the same way he says, you know, I can understand, you know, why I spent those 10 years doing. I was incredibly stubborn. I was bullheaded. And I didn't have a teacher that who really showed me the way. So therefore, but he's saying my efforts were in vain. Now, you know, in the sense that he had a great awakening, gives the story a very positive cast. Right? On the other hand, if he had died, you know, if he had spit and just, you know, and then expired, you know, that would have been a different story. Yes.
This is not a question.
Yes.
But could you please repeat the question?
Oh, for the, yeah, so I'm, yeah. So these last two questions related to really the same thing. Was it in vain? And he's clearly saying, yes, all his efforts at this arduous practice of looking outside, you know, in practices for the answer, what was in vain? So those were good questions. So that's... And then again, you know, you can find it online, or you can there's another book I'm reading, and tomorrow I'll bring down the other one. Or when they're basically two books in English. This is called The Unborn Life and Teachings of Zen Master Bankei, 1693, translated with introduction by Norman Waddell. This is the revised edition, published by North Point Press, and the other one is by a guy named Haskell. I would imagine they're still in print, and I think he was at Columbia University, and that's where he in the Asian department. And he also did the translations. So again, his trajectory was he did seek out different teachers. He did continue practicing for many years, and he did begin to teach. And eventually became quite famous. As I said, thousands would come from all things, and he would have these long retreats that would go on for a month, 2 months, 3 months, where all kinds of people, as I said, would come, and he'd be putting them up in temples, and some temples, and people would be living all around. It was a real Dharma Woodstock. Kind of thing, and just every day, all he would teach, and he would all have people come before him and have interchanges. He was really devoted to waking people up, and even though they said the atmosphere, there are some of his disciples in their recollections after he had passed away, did kind of write about their experience with him. They said it was a very unusual place because even though it did not have that kind of discipline of the Japanese Zen monasteries, which he rejected, there was a very, they say, wonderful atmosphere of self-discipline and seriousness. And but yet he was very he was very open. I mean. You know, people who wanted to sit and meditate would sit and meditate all day. If they wanted to chant, they would chant. If they had to get up because they had duties to do in the kitchen or whatever, just go do that. If they were peasants who had to get up and take care of things in their fields or with their animals, they were free to go do that. I mean, it was he created a certain kind of atmosphere of self-discipline and seriousness that was not oppressive. Nor was it seemingly highly structured. There's a beautiful talk in here. Again, a lot of his interchanges are great, where he gives a whole talk to somebody about, because I think people were bothered by these people who were sleeping during the day. And he said, let them go. You know, some people are doing meditation, Zazen in the Buddha mind. Some people are chanting in the Amitabha Buddha in the Buddha mind. Some people are sleeping in the Buddha mind. And he said it's all arising in the Buddha mind. So don't discriminate. I mean, he was quite a master. So he would tell people, said, you know, we got to, sort of reminds me of those of you who in the Shantideva. Bodhicara intensive, you know, Shantideva was quite at Nalanda, at the great Buddhist university. You know, he also was, very much looked down on by his peers because he really spent the day eating, sleeping, and defecating. That's what they called it. That's what they said. He just he didn't seem to do much more than that. So those who uphold too high standards of how things should appear were very upset by somebody like him. So let me, quite a wonderful teacher, quite a marvelous teacher, a very unusual, as you'll see in his teachings, and he was passionate. I mean, his having nearly killed himself from the way he practiced, and because of the Zen at the time, which again was very arduous. I mean, life in the monasteries, very disciplined, very ascetic. The koan systems, the whole deal was very austere. His experience rejected that. He said, you know, you don't need to do all that. And he was, again, because of his own experience, but as well as within the context of Zen at that time, he was very passionate about this. And again, it's interesting enough, as we say, that because he was a kind of a rebel, and because he really blazed his own path, and because he was so so much into the immediacy of what he was doing and wanted the live interchange, it was not thinking about posterity and fame and founding a tradition and all that. Over generations, his teaching slowly did disappear and was absorbed into the institutions that he railed against at the time. So, but that's history. So this is from, again, there are two collections of what they here they're calling sermons from his talks. This is one that he gave in 1690, the 23rd day of the 8th month, and this they call this the midday sermon. So he might have gotten given many talks. So this is Bunke. What I teach everyone in these talks of mine is the unborn Buddha mind of illuminative wisdom. Nothing else. So he's very clear, I only teach one thing. Okay? Is this Buddha mind? And again, we'll go into this more in depth. So this is what? This is Buddha mind, the mind of a Buddha. Or we could say this is enlightened mind. And obviously he's distinguishing this from thinking mind, everyday mind. So he calls it. So he says, I only talk about Buddha mind, and he says, and you remember that's the big word in his enlightenment experience, unborn. So this is another important thing to understand. He's saying this Buddha mind is unborn. Unborn means what? It never came into being. If it's unborn, it means it always is, always was, always will be. I mean, even to use that is to chop it up into time. So he's saying unborn, it always is. It was never born. It was never given birth to by the Buddhas, nor do individuals who awaken to it give birth to it. Right? It is always here. It is never born, of course, means it never dies. And he calls it the unborn mind of illuminative wisdom. So he's now also saying that this unborn Buddha mind, which is all that he says I talk about, has the capacity of illuminating, of illuminative wisdom. Okay, so wisdom is what? Understanding. But an understanding that understands the nature of things, the reality of things, it kind of understands everything. And it's illuminative, which means what? It lights everything up. Right. So he's kind of, in these very few words, he's saying, I only teach about this Buddha mind that is unborn, never been born, and that it has this natural capacity for clarity and wisdom. Okay? Next sentence. Everyone is endowed with this Buddha mind, only he or she doesn't know it. Okay? So, everyone includes who? All of us. So, everyone in this room is included in everyone. So please understand, he is talking about our own mind, your own mind, that you have, you are endowed with this Buddha mind. It's like Ken over there, right? He's looking for his glasses. Right? Bunke is saying, you have glasses that allow you to see clearly. They're right on you right now. The problem is you don't see it. Right? That's what he's saying. This is very important. Okay? This is what the Buddhas and masters have always said to us. What? This is what the Buddha said on his enlightenment 2,500 years ago. Right? Who would have ever believed that I had within me this Buddha mind? Right? And that all beings have it. The only difference between a Buddha and a sentient being is this one fact. Right. When an ordinary being comes to understand and realize their Buddha mind, immediately they are a Buddha. Right. If you don't understand that you have this Buddha mind, are this Buddha mind, you're just an ordinary being. That is why Bankei, in one instant, had a transformation. Right? He went from being it's like Ken over here. Right? I mean, Ken, he's driving us all crazy because all he ever does is, anybody see my glasses? You know, he's always looking for his glasses. You know, he's kind of obsessive, compulsive, neurotic. I mean, he's just endlessly looking for his glasses. So he's running around, right? And all of a sudden, when he realizes they're on him all the time, it's like he's at peace, right? Can you imagine his great peace at that moment, right? Running, frenetic. I am all the time. Can you see how happy he would be? How relieved he would be? And how different his life would be, right? I mean, he hasn't even been able to work or attend to family matters. He's been so obsessed with finding his glasses. Now look, he's got all the time in the world, right? So it's like that. So everyone is endowed with this Buddha mind, only he doesn't know it, or she doesn't know it. My reason for coming and speaking to you like this is to make it known to you. Okay, is that clear? I mean, that's what he's saying. This is why I'm showing up today, to let you know about this, that you have it. So then, obviously, the question he asks next, which is the obvious one, is, well then, he says, what does it mean you're endowed with the Buddha mind, right? Because he just told us, but we don't understand what he's talking about. So then he says, and please listen very carefully, and don't think about this, just listen. Each of you now present decided to come here from your home in the desire to hear what I had to say. Right? So he's saying, all of you came here today because of an intention, your intention to come. Now, if a dog barked beyond the temple walls while you were listening to me, you'd hear it, and you know it, and you'd know it was a dog barking. If a crow cawed, you'd hear it, and know it was a crow. You'd hear an adult's voice as an adult's voice, and a child's voice as a child's voice. Okay? So he's saying, even though you thought or had the intention to come here to have this talk, just when these spontaneous things occur, right, that have nothing to do with, you know, why you thought you were here today, a dog barks, and you know it's a dog barking, right? A bird calls, you know it's a bird calling, right? But you hear a child's voice, you know it's a child's voice. You hear an adult's voice, you know it's an adult's voice. He said, you didn't come here to hear any of this. Yet while you're here, you hear these sounds. Also, your eyes see and distinguish reds and whites and other colors. And your nose can tell good smells from bad smells. Now, you never had any way of knowing beforehand, before coming here today, that you would encounter these sights, sounds, or smell. And yet, here you are, nevertheless, able to recognize these unforeseen sights and sounds as you encounter them, without any premeditation. Here's the clincher. That is because you're seeing and hearing in the unborn. Just let that sink in. Even though you have this intention for what is going to occur that you might have generated, I'm going to the temple to hear Bankhe talk, right? And yet, while you're there, you hear things, you smell things, right? And your mind or something immediately knows what it is. Without even thinking, right? Like, we don't have to call that, right? We know what that is before we say, sneeze. Right? Right? Everybody knew what that was before we said, sneeze. What knew that? What knew that? That's what he's pointing at. There's something here that knows, right? I was reading this earlier and thinking, like a child, like an infant, right? They don't have language, do they? Right? And yet, when something's making them sad, they cry. And when something's happy, they smile, right? When they have needs, they let the parent know it in very direct ways, right? Now, parents are quite happy and children are quite happy when they get a little language, because now what? They can tell you in words what it is that's bothering them. But that doesn't say before they got words, they didn't know what was bothering them, right? The only difference is now they have words so they can tell somebody what's bothering. They knew what was bothering them, right? Beforehand. There is a knowing, he's saying. Now, what is this mind that knows? Right? Knows it's happy or unhappy, knows it's cold or knows it's hot, knows it's comfortable or uncomfortable, right? Knows without even thinking that it's a sneeze and not a cough. Before a thought even arises, what is that? Or I could say, what is this? This is very simple. Be very careful here. Do not intellectualize. This is the great gift of Bhanke. He's just putting it right out there. If we were listening, we might have just been aware that the AC went on. But before I said the AC went on, there was a knowing, right? What knows? What has that wisdom of knowing? That you do see, now again he's talking about the dogs and the crows and the colors and the smells and all that. He said, that you do see and hear and smell in this way without giving rise to the thought that you will is the proof that the inherent Buddhist, that this inherent Buddha mind is unborn and possessed of a wonderful illuminative wisdom. What was that, Katie? All right. So he's leading us down the path, and he's proving his point. Okay. He's saying, Katie, that the reason that you knew that was a sneeze, even before you said sneeze, or even though you were thinking you were here just to hear Fred's talk, and not to pay attention to people sneezing or air conditioning going on or birds calling. He said, this is proof that there is this unborn, you know, maybe a better word that may be helpful to you rather than mind could be awareness. That may be a word that may work better for us. There is this awareness, right, that precedes thought, right, and that has the capacity of knowing. And as opposed to a thought which arises and passes, comes and goes, is here and not, this awareness that knows, right? So if I said to you, Katie, this awareness, right, that knew there was a sneeze, that knows it's the AC before you label it, that just knows, that knows if you're hot or cold, this awareness, can you remember, you know, when it started? No. That is called the unborn.
Yeah.
No, that's all right. No, I'm belaboring the point. It needs to be belabored. Okay? Thought, we can remember when we didn't have it, right? You can say, oh, you know, 2 minutes ago I had that thought, and now it's gone. It participated in what? Birth and death. Okay? I can remember when I was here and not here. Right? Okay. But if I said to you that awareness, can you remember when that wasn't present? And you'd have to say, I can't. Right? When you go to sleep at night, are you aware? When you first thing you wake up in the morning, is there awareness? You dream? When is there a moment when awareness is not present? He's calling this the unborn Buddha mind. When a dog howls, even if 10 million people said in a chorus that it was the sound of a crow cawing, I doubt if you'd be convinced. Right. So he's saying this knowing is strong, right? And it cannot be confused by people's opinions, right? So if you ate a hot chili pepper, Some of you had a hot, salsa last night, right? And some of you, right? But it was hot, right? Now, if somebody came up to you and said, "Wasn't that a delicious sweet salsa?" Right? You would know not by thinking, but by knowing. You would say no. And the words you spoke, "It was hot," would just be putting into thought what you already know. Right? What knows? What knows? Before a thought arises, what knows? According to Bhante, it is your unborn Buddha mind. It's always functioning. So we said, you know, these 10 million people are trying to talk you out of believing that a dog howling is really a co-cawing. It's highly unlikely there would be any way they could delude you into believing what they said. That is owing to the marvelous awareness and bornness of your Buddha mind. Now, please, if you are confused, good. Because what he's telling you is what? Nobody, what's he saying? Nobody told you this before. Right? That's why he's teaching us this. Saying, nobody told you. Nobody told me this. Right, I went around and all I heard from this teacher and that, do this practice, do that practice, think this, think that, study this, study that, right? He's saying, I'm giving it right to you. Nobody ever gave it to me this way, right? So simple, so direct, so obvious. You hear the wolf howling. You all know that, don't you? Even before you said a bird or whatever it is, you knew what it was. What knew? Right on cue. Again, that's owing to the marvelous awareness and unbornness of your Buddha mind. Then he goes on. The reason I say it's in the unborn, quote, that you see and hear in this way is because the mind does not give, quote unquote, birth to any thought or inclination to see and hear. What does he mean? He means that when the bell was invited a moment ago, we didn't have to think, "I'm going to listen to it now." Did anybody think that? Or when the bird was cawing, the thought before you listened, before you understood and heard the bird, the thought did not arise, "I'm going to listen to the bird," right? Thought did not precede that. Spontaneously and naturally, you heard and you understood. What is that? that, he says, is neither other than our unborn Buddha mind. We could say pure awareness. Functioning. Functioning brilliantly. Right? For all everybody here who believes it's only through control and manipulation that things get done. Here's living proof how wrong you are. Right? Just sitting here, doing absolutely nothing. Right? We know there's a bell. We know there's a bird. Right? We know this, we know that. Right? How easy. How easy things really are. So he says, again, so much of our life is just our Buddha mind spontaneously, naturally responding to things. It's not about thought. Try this one on. Even if you thought something first, right? Like maybe you're walking... you're out for a walk and the thought, and then all of a sudden you think, I'm going to go walk in the labyrinth, right? You might have that thought. What produced that thought? Why did that thought just arise? Where did it come from? What produced it? Right? Did you have a thought before that? I need to think about what I'm going to do. You know, can you see it's you get lost in there. And all you can finally say is what? I have no idea why that thought arose. It just arose. Right? Spontaneously, naturally. Well, what did it arise from? The unborn Buddha mind. That's what told you to go walk in the labyrinth. Right? You know, who's... Another way to say it is, who's in command here? We think it's our thoughts. We think it's me. But is that really true? Right? So again, the reason I say it's the unborn because you don't see... the reason I say it's in the unborn that you see and hear in this way is because the mind doesn't give, quote-unquote, birth to any thought or inclination to see or hear, right? Therefore, it is unborn. Being unborn, it is also undying. It is not possible for what is not born to perish. This is the sense in which I say that all people have an unborn Buddha mind. Now, does anybody want to dispute Bunke? And I'll just—I'll sort of be his lawyer. I'll represent him since, you know, at this moment there's no one else here to dispute on his behalf. Yes, well, Alex. Yes.
I don't want to dispute Bunke, but I want to ask a question.
Yes.
Before Bunke, or preceding Bunke, by many years, there was a great teacher, and his name was Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed that when we're born with all the knowledge that we have, and that we spend the rest of our life remembering what we forgot when we were born. So it's a counterintuitive sort of, you know, expression of knowledge. So, since Socrates preceded Bunke by about 2,000 years, my question is, did Bunke read Socrates?
I would say, unless you are clear who Socrates read, I would say to you, perhaps both Bunke and Socrates had the same teacher, which is the unborn Buddha mind. And that's the truth. I mean, I'm not just being facetious. I mean, this is not, we have to understand, this unborn Buddha mind, unborn mind, intuitive, illuminative knowledge is not, doesn't belong to anybody. right? It's all we can say is, I'll just interpret your point is, yeah, isn't this incredible, right? You find somebody over here, you find different historical epochs, and they're all saying the same thing. Again, the Greek language is different than the Japanese language, and the culture is different, so it's expressed a different way. But what are they, what is teaching them? Yeah, they tapped into this, and all of a sudden it became crystal clear. And again, you have a guy like Socrates, very much like Bonnke. Bonnke is saying, even if 10 million people tell you, a dog is a crow, it's not true. And we know that Socrates, he was willing to die because he was going to speak his truth. I mean, he knew it was true. And when he was threatened, it comes from the same, Bonnke, even though Bonnke overcame, he had a lot of opposition. Because he was, especially all the people who were involved in these institutional ways of learning, even in Zen and the koan system said, this is not Zen, or this is light Zen, or this is, this or that, because it's not the real thing. But he was, you can see how strong he is, and if you read his writings, he was, right, so. Or perhaps, if you believe in rebirth, you might even think that maybe Bonnke was the reincarnation of Socrates. Who knows? Right?
The other similarity to the two is that Socrates didn't write down his teachings either. They're known to us in Plato.
Right. Yeah.
I think he plagiarized.
Maybe he is Socrates. He's not. He's only plagiarizing himself. But obviously, he hadn't learned anything in 500 years, did he? About writing things down, that is. Susan?
Headstrongness, egocentricity create delusion, and delusion keeps us from seeing the suchness of things. I think it is possible that great suffering cuts through that sometimes. It's not essential, but sometimes it cuts through all that delusion, and it makes the delusion more evident as delusion. And then you see the suchness of things. So I think, while it's not essential for what Bonnke said, it's not essential to go through the suffering to see the seeing that you're describing, that he's describing, I think sometimes suffering can cut through all this buildup of delusion and egocentricity and help you see just what's there.
Yeah, of course. But again, what you're talking about is the individual story. Okay, what you might say that obviously this is a man who suffered greatly, right? Obviously he didn't have a happy childhood, he didn't have a happy adolescence, and obviously even in his 10 years of his spiritual searching until his enlightenment, he was not a happy camper, right? It was just endless suffering. Mental suffering, physical suffering. Even as a child, his father died young. He was always getting in trouble. His elder brother would beat him up. He'd go to school. He was never right. So there was great suffering, and we can say that energized his search. But again, having said that, that's his journey, and we may say then that. Contributed to his greatness. In a certain way, we could say, if I've been looking for my glasses for 2 minutes, right? I just started looking. I said, Susan, have you seen my glasses? And Susan goes, they're on Fred. They're on your head. I might be grateful. I might be. Oh, God, that was a little silly. But my emotional response would be very low key, right? On the other hand. If I was like poor Ken over here, and it had been 20 years I've been looking for these glasses, and had gone through all kinds of things looking for these glasses, and if one day Susan says, Fred, they're right on your head, can you imagine my happiness and relief would be so much more so, right? So I think that's maybe what you're saying in Bonnke. His great relief and happiness and transformation obviously came out of the suffering of his life up to that point, but also very clearly he's saying, you don't have to do it. You know what I'm saying? you know, you can just post note, you know, post-its around your house saying, you know, next time you're looking for your glasses, check your head first. You're right. You know, I mean, you don't have to, right? Or something. You know, that's what he's saying. So, yeah. Continuing with Bankei.
Mm-hmm. So, given that there's awareness that's pre-thought awareness, you don't really have to do anything. It's just we all have that. But that doesn't. I don't have to think crow to hear it, to know that that is, you know, the sound of a bird. But it's not equally available to us to be able to see the ultimate reality.
Really? Is there such a thing as ultimate reality?
Well, to be able to see things as, to be able to see that there's no reality in phenomena, isn't that what we read this morning as one of our chants, that there's no reality in phenomena, that mm-hmm. things are not what they appear to be?
And if I was Bankei, I'd say to you, when you rest in the unborn mind, that is all resolved, and you will see things just as they are.
So if someone like Bankei says, you don't have to suffer so much, it's really, I can teach you. So did he, did the people in his audience, were they able to have his experiences?
He was greatly loved, greatly admired, and thousands and thousands and thousands flocked to his teachings. And I mean, again, I you can read the same books I have. It seems, I would imagine, he was a very effective teacher. Yeah, because you can even get a sense from a lot of the in the dialogues that a lot of the people who came to him were monks and nuns in other traditions who had practiced for many years and were quite blown away by his teaching. So, again, I'm not a historian, but just from reading these things, somebody who collects so many students from all over and so many who are practitioners of other paths, we get a sense is, yes, he must have been a very effective teacher, and he must have helped in the liberation of many beings through his very direct, open teaching. Continuing on. Each and every Buddha and Bodhisattva in the universe, these are all the great enlightened beings. This morning we enumerated them, we offered our respect and our praise and our love to them, we bowed before them. So he says, all these fully enlightened beings who are manifesting this wonderful energy of, as was recited this morning, great compassion, great understanding, great liberative powers and techniques, etc. He said, all of those guys and girls and everyone in this world of humans as well has been endowed with it. Now again, this is very important. Actually, when I just said girls, it was very interesting. I don't know if I'll go into it, but those of you who may consider yourself girls or women, he was very strong. I've never read anybody this strong about that women are equal to men in having the Buddha nature. Asian society that Buddhism developed in was traditionally very patriarchal, obviously. And in the hierarchy of things, it was considered a much better rebirth to be a man than a woman. You know, that's very... If those of you who know history know that that was part of the mythology of these cultures, some even till today. It's interesting, there are whole sections here where Bankei says that that's nonsense. Men and women are equal. Actually, he goes on to say, there's some very interesting parts, I won't go into it, that women actually have much more capability spiritually than men. They're a bunch of blockheads, he kind of says. You know, and he really says that women have much more of a capacity at this than men. I mean, it's a very interesting guy. And he does the same kind of things with... He said, I'll prove it to you. He said, he goes on and goes on. No, he said, if a man hears this sound or a woman hears this sound, you know, do they hear it any differently? He said, of course not. You know, I mean, he said, so the idea that kind of men have one kind of mind and women have another kind of mind, just nonsense. I mean, if you're interested, there's some really wonderful dialogues in there. And then again, as I say, he goes on to talk about how actually women, he thinks, are more capable of understanding his teaching than men. They're just a bunch of blockheads. Okay, so each and every Buddha and Bodhisattva in the universe, and everyone in the world of humans as well, has been endowed with it. But being ignorant of this fact that you have a Buddha mind, you live in illusion. The illusion of what? That, you know, it's really your small little mind that is running the show. And that this great unborn Buddha mind that has this great capacity for illuminative wisdom belongs only to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but not to us. That is our illusion. Right? It's not real. Now, as some of you have been asking, why is it that I'm deluded? Right? How did I get into this fix that I can't, you know, that I don't even, you know, that I don't even realize that I have this great awareness, this great Buddha mind, unborn. It has this great capacity for knowing, even before a thought arises, the difference between a cow and a horse, and can tell, a sneeze from a cough, right? So that knows when we're sleeping, and the bell goes off in the morning, most of us know right away what. It's time to get up. We know that, don't we? Even before the bell arises, we know it's time to get up. Even before we think, oh my God, it's time to get up. Right? I can't believe that bell. Right? Something else knows that we need to get up. So why is it that you're deluded? And Bhante says to you, because you're partial to yourself. He doesn't mess around. Very simple, very direct. Doesn't spin a lot of highfalutin words. Because you're partial to yourself. Just let that sink in a moment. For those of you who are maybe thinking here, why don't I know this as a reality, this unborn Buddha mind? Why doesn't my illuminative wisdom, why isn't it shining brightly in all directions? Because you're partial to yourself. You're not partial to your Buddha mind. You're partial to yourself. So then, again, Bhante is wonderful because his illustrations are very simple, and you can see why he was so popular. Because even people who are, you know, lots and lots of so-called understanding of Buddhist teachings and philosophy, or whether you're just the most simple peasant, right, who's never read a word of Buddhist teachings, he says, so what does that mean? Well, let's take something close to home. So, you know, what does this mean that you're partial to yourself? He said, suppose you heard your next-door neighbor whispering bad things about you, right? You'd immediately what? Get angry. Every time you saw your neighbor's face, you'd immediately get indignant. You'd think, what an unreasonable, hateful person. And then anything that person said afterwards would appear to you in a bad light. Why? All because you're wedded to yourself. By becoming angry, losing your temper, you just transformed your Buddha mind into the evil existence of the fighting spirits. Now this is, if you read Bhante, he very much uses the kind of the Buddhist cosmology of the six realms. I don't know if people know about the six realms, but this is a traditional way of kind of looking at, whether you believe these worlds actually existed, the six worlds, or whether you saw them as mind states, but they are the worlds of, there are six of them, six realms. And in the lower, and if you've seen paintings of what's called the Wheel of Life, the six realms are painted there. It's a common pictorial representation of the Buddha's path, but in many temples and everything, when you go to Asia, they're actually there painted. So the six realms, these lower realms, which lower realms meaning most painful, have to do with hell realms, hungry ghost realms, and animal realms, right? Hell realm is a realm of just deep, deep suffering, you know. Sort of like those you're familiar with Dante's hells, you know, it's like that. And it's acknowledging that many human beings dwell in hell. Right? That their minds are just a source, their lives are just a source of unremitting suffering to them. Right? And they have no idea how to get out of it. Right? Life is just torturous. Okay. So that's the hell realm. Hungry ghost realm, again, you know, these are wonderful teachings. I find them fascinating. I won't go into them. The hungry ghost realm is this realm of constant need. The hungry ghosts are always, they feel deficient. So they're always wanting, needing, you know. They're hungry ghosts, right? They're always hungry. But they, no matter how much they eat, they're never satisfied. They always want more, more, more. They're coming from that place of lack. You know, whether it's I need love, I need food, I need appreciation, I need to be noticed, I need, you know, I need to be liked, I need, right? And no matter how much they get, it never fills them up. So they're always needing more. That's the hungry ghost realm. Animal realm is a realm of kind of animalism. You know, it's kind of just dumb. I mean, you can't ever figure things out. You know, animals are just, all they can do is what they do. You know what I mean? The dogs can never go to get together and go, you know, maybe there's a different life for us. You know, maybe if we all kind of pool our resources together, you know, we can... in other words, animals have little or no capacity for self-reflection, for self-understanding, for any type of transformation. Now, for those of you who love animals, I can hear you already. This is psychological. This is not saying that that dogs aren't wonderful and they're not loving and they don't have a certain kind of intelligence. Okay, please don't even go there. Okay, this is, you know, I'm not going to belabor this point, but it's a representation that in terms of a rebirth, of a place to live, animals, there's a lot of suffering. I mean, we look at our animals out here. I mean, they have very little capacity not to just live out their existence. I mean, even though we are moved by the sweet singing of birds, right? Please also know that they're constantly moving about. Have you noticed that? Why are they constantly moving about? Because they're afraid. Constantly, animals in nature are looking out for predators, right? There's always somebody who wants to eat them, right? And that's just there's a lot of fear in nature. And again, you go... Well, why don't they all get together and form a band and appoint lookouts and, you know, build little fortresses and, right? You know, right? We, as human beings, we would do that, wouldn't they? But they're animals. You know, they have very limited capacity in that cognitive way. So those are the lower realms. The human realm is in the three kind of upper ones of the sir. I won't go into the human realm, but. Basically what he's talking here when he talks about when you get angry, you transform yourself into the fighting spirits. The fighting spirits are the assurers, and they're just full of competition. They're always angry, they're always competitive, they always want power over somebody or other. They're always resentful, they're always starting wars, they're always paying people back. You know, these are... You know, these are them, and many times, you know, they rise up as opposed to the ones in the lower realm. They often rise up and get to run corporations and become generals, and because they can fuel that competitiveness and the desire to have power over and to accumulate, and they can channel their anger into, you know, what's socially acceptable in a society, which is what? competitiveness. You know, I want to rise up faster than you. Right? I want to get ahead of you. Right? So those are the assurers. Oh, and then we'll stop here. So basically what he's saying here is you take this Buddha mind, right? Here you are resting at home, very peacefully, enjoying the birds, right? And all of a sudden you hear, somebody comes and said, do you hear what Doug said about you? You know what I mean? And all of a sudden it's like, you know, Doug. Right, you think about it. When you see him in the street, you're fantasizing all the ways you'd like to tell him off. You know what I mean? You're only hoping bad things happen to him, right? What happened? Why? How did this peaceful Buddha mind become this this mind of a fighting spirit? Because this person dared to say something about you that you didn't want to hear, right? Why? Because you're partial to yourself. Then he goes on. Now, if your neighbor praised you instead, said something that pleased you, right? So now Doug is, I hear that Doug just really was praising me up, right? Now when I think of Doug, what a wonderful guy. He's so intelligent and perceptive, you know what I'm saying? Right, and if I saw him, I would get a big smile on my face. You know what I mean? I would, is there anything I can do for you? You see what I'm saying? I would, right? I would only want him to succeed in life, right? Even if he, Mike says, even if the praise was totally undeserved, and the pleasure you felt unfounded, just a product of your wishful thinking, you'd still be happy, right? I mean, it doesn't matter. The delight you experience when this happens is due to that same obstinate constitutional preference for yourself. Could he be more clear? Is there anybody who does not understand what he's saying? Okay? And he's just using a very personal graphic example. To show how this unborn Buddha mind, right, that just reflects what is, can just like that turn into this rageful, angry demon when it just hears one, just a hearsay that somebody said something negative about us. And at the same time, can go into, paeans of ecstasy and happiness when it hears that it was praised. Just like that. Why? Because we are partial to ourselves. And he doesn't say it here, but I'll just take it one step. You know, let's imagine that I heard Doug, I heard that Doug said something negative about Steve. Would I get angry? No, I'd go, I don't know. Maybe you're right. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? I would be totally unconcerned. I mean, I wouldn't care that, maybe he's that he's hurt poor Steve, or, you know what I'm saying? It'd be like, oh, see, it's not about me, right? It's not about me. So, I mean, Doug can go on and talking angry about this one or praising that one, right? It doesn't affect, I'm still, quite happy, right? But when it's about me, then immediately that unborn Buddha mind, with its illuminative wisdom, is turned into what? A raging demon, right? Or a blissful deva, because I'd be so happy now. I'm liked, loved, well thought of. Right? So he was just like that. That's his proof. If you want proof, how did your pure Buddha mind, how does it get, and if you multiply that by what? A million? 100,000, 10,000 incidences over time, you can see why it is we do not dwell in our Buddha mind. Yes?
Is it that the Buddha mind turns into this raging ego, or that it's obscured by the machinations of ego because our attention goes to the self and is distracted from...
Say that again.
Does the Buddha mind turn?
No, he would not say it turned. He would say it's be, yeah, is he the question is that, you know, does, again, we're just using semantics. We could certainly say, I mean, in a certain sense, we could say, yes, it's turned in. I mean, these are just words. Yeah, I mean, at that point, our pure Buddha mind, is it turned into a raging demon? In a certain, say, in a, from a certain point of view, we could say yes. I mean, from the point of view of watching, of seeing it occur, it feels like it, right? If you said to me, does that mean that my pure Buddha, unborn Buddha mind is no longer there? No, it's just obscured by what? By my, this partiality that's causing me to act out in a certain way, and then all the emotions come up and the obsessions come up, and it's now covered over. So, does that make sense? Yeah. Right. And of course, that is the important, I mean, that the, even though it feels like, I mean, this is, maybe that's important, even though it feels like that my unborn Buddha mind has turned into this raging demon, the truth is, no, there's nothing solid or permanent in that raging demon. It's just like a cloud that is just obscuring your truth, and that's why you can, if you want, immediately return when you see it clearly. You know, what's going on. He says, just stop and look back to the origin of this self of yours. When you were born, your parents didn't give you any happy, evil, or bitter thoughts. Right? You just had your Buddha mind. Again, whether you can remember back to your own infancy and remember that, or just if you've been, you know, if you had the privilege of being around infants or newborns, you realize what? They're just resting in their unborn mind. They have no thoughts. They have no inclinations. You know, they don't think evil about anybody. They're not judging anybody. They don't have any self-esteem issues. You know, they're just what? Just here. Right? Just like that. There was only your Buddha mind. Afterwards, when your intelligence appeared... So it's interesting. This is, you know, in a certain way, those of you who studied child psychology, child development, in a very rudimentary way, he kind of understands it, doesn't he? He says, when your intelligence appears, actually, I would put that intelligence in quotes, but he actually didn't. When your intelligence appear, you heard and saw other people saying and doing bad things, and you learned them, and you made them yours. So he's, in a certain way, he's saying that all of our mind originally was pure. We could say was a blank slate, right? And that imprinting started, right, very early on, whether it's, you know, in other words, whether it was through imprinting or whether it was through just our own, as our own cognitive capacities developed, we were able to begin to put the world together. Well, how do we put the world together? We put it together through what's going on around us, right? I mean, very few of us are so self-actualized early on that we are not affected by what's going on around us. So you saw and heard other people saying and doing things, and then you learned them and made them yours, all these habits. By the time you reached adulthood, deep-seated habits formed in this way of your own manufacture has emerged, right? So in other words, unknowingly, we took the stuff that we saw around us, the words, the deeds, the actions of those we you know, and through the power of our own capacities, we internalize it, right? And we created these structures and formations, so now they are ours, right? These are our ways of looking. These are our issues. This is now our, right. Now, okay. Formed in this way based on your own manufacture. So we have nobody to blame but ourselves. Okay, because we now have manufactured these structures, these mental formations within ourselves has emerged. Now, cherishing yourself and your own ideas You have turned your Buddha mind into the path, in this case, of fighting spirits. And again, he goes on, sort of what we're saying. If you covet what belongs to other people, kindling selfish desires for something that can never be yours, you create the path of hungry ghosts, and you change the Buddha mind into that kind of existence. This is what is known as transmigration. So as opposed to conceptualizing transmigration as something that goes over lifetimes, you know, we transmigrate, like we're born in the human realm, and if we don't, not careful, next lifetime we'll transmigrate and become an animal or a hungry ghost. He's saying no. Just moving from mind state to mind state in this life, this is transmigration, right? That we're constantly leaving our original, unborn, pure mind, right? And turning it into a demon, turning it into a hungry ghost, turning it into a rageful, turning into a needing this, and an angry this, and a fearful this, and an unhappy this, you know. Why? Because of our partiality to self, our egocentricity, our egoism, our self-centeredness, you know, there are lots of terms. So he's laying the blame clearly where? On self. And a clinging, an attachment, a partiality towards self. Well, I think I've given you enough for one day. Or I would say, I think banke. So just to recapitulate, please please imagine that you have spent the last hour and a half in the presence of Bhante, have heard his very clear and simple teachings, and that you will spend the rest of the day reflecting and practicing. He didn't get into the practice yet. We'll get into that tomorrow. But it's obvious, you know, his practice is quite simple. Stay. S-T-A-Y. Stay in your unborn mind. Do not leave it for the realms of the fighting demons. Do not leave it for realms of suffering. Do not leave it for realms of unhappiness. Do not leave it to ruminate about the past. Do not leave it to fantasize about the future. Rest. Stay in your unborn awareness. Your true mind. The mind that you were, he says elsewhere, he says, this is the gift your parents gave you. Right? If there's one gift they gave you that you need to be grateful for, they gave you your unborn Buddha mind. Right? It was there, always. You came out of the womb with it. You had it in the womb. Right? And because of this and that, we traded it in for a self. And all that has caused us since then is what? What?
Grief
and suffering and confusion and emotional ability. And right? On and on and on and on. Never given us what we really wanted, which was what? Peace, happiness. Right? And he said, you had it. Right? Babies have it, right? They only are unhappy as long as their needs aren't being met. As soon as they're very, and they're very simple needs, right? You know, feed me, keep me warm, change my diaper, right? Hold me. It's not very elaborate, is it? And as long as those needs are met, right? As soon as their needs were met, what happened? What happened to their suffering? Remember people who had crying babies? What happens immediately when their needs are met? Their simple needs are met. They immediately what? Stop crying. It's over. Right? I mean, suffering is very specific. It's very based on basic needs. And as soon as the need is met, happiness. Big smile. Right? Crying a minute ago, you change the diaper. What happens? Right, Nadia knows, right? Right, your child is how old?
7 months.
So when he's crying because he didn't change that diaper, what happens? No, when you did change the diaper.
Oh, he's done.
He's done, and he's what? Yeah. Let's happy. Let's go on. He's not there still resenting you. Right? Where were you when I cried? Right? I mean, I expect you there immediately. Right? I mean, you know, he's not chewing over for the rest of the day, is he? Can't believe what. How did I end up with a mother like that? You know what I mean? You know, we're going on, right? Everybody else has mothers that come to them. Even, you know, a good mother should be there even before I even cry, right? I mean, that's a good mother. But look what I got stuck with. And all day long, he ruminates on that, right? Luckily, you're blessed that you don't have a child like that. He immediately forgives you, right? It's over. And now he's happy. Why? Because he's resting in his Buddha mind. He hasn't developed a self yet that can weave these intricate stories of, right, of lesson and rejection. You know what I mean? All that stuff that we have carefully cultivated for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, right? Is everybody clear? This is deep, this is simple, but profound. It cuts again. Coming back to this guy over here, he's been suffering for 20 years looking for his glasses. Right? Just suffering, 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 and causing all kinds of problems to everybody else.
40 years.
Yeah. And in 1 minute, when he found out his glasses were on his, it's over. The drama's over. Right? He's at peace. Look at him. Could it be that simple? I leave that to you.